Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. 66 years ago today, Jackie Robinson became the first African-American to play for a Major League Baseball team.
In his college days, he was an All-America halfback at UCLA, as well as a prominent basketball star and a National Collegiate Broad Jump champion. Branch Rickey brought Robinson into big-time baseball, and on April 11, 1947, Jackie started his 10-year career with the Brooklyn Dodgers. A brilliant infielder, he became a spark plug of the colorful Brooks with his fierce competitive spirit, timely hitting, and daring base running. He won Rookie of the Year honors, batted 342 in 49 to top the National League, and was named that year's most valuable player.
That was an event that changed baseball and the country. A new film, 42, tells the story of how Robinson was recruited and signed by the general manager of the Brooklyn Dodgers, Branch Rickey. Rickey was a son of Ohio and an alum of Ohio Wesleyan University in Delaware. This weekend, the university is holding special events to commemorate Rickey and the new film. For more information, visit our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Joining us now to discuss the story of Jackie Robinson and Branch Rickey is Rickey's grandson, Branch B. Rickey. Like his namesake, he also has made a career in baseball and is currently president of the AAA Pacific Coast League. Welcome to the show, Branch.
Thank you very much, Ann. I'm pleased to be joining you.
You know, in that newsreel, it's pretty telling that it's all about, and it's probably well should be, Jackie Robinson, but the Branch Rickey part of it was sublimated. Really, you know, people, you had to know the business and kind of know how things work to care who Branch Rickey was.
Well, the Rickey legacy is certainly a proud one for me to carry, and what a wonderful thing to be passed down to a grandson. But candidly, the greater part of that for me is not so much who he was and what he accomplished, but the fact that he was my grandfather, and we had a wonderful, warm, loving relationship. I enjoy that legacy more as a grandson than as somebody who has seen some major accomplishment passed along. But I have to then go back and look at the accomplishment and share with you that my grandfather, I think, saw this as certainly something that he would be remembered by, but he didn't want credit for it. He didn't think that this was the kind of thing I remember him saying, and he said in almost an Elizabethan manner, it would shame a man. It would shame a man to take credit for righting a wrong that just had existed so long and needed to be corrected. He saw this as a kind of a fulfillment of the steps that Abraham Lincoln had taken 100 years before. And he thought that the American system had failed to live up to that obligation. He had such admiration for Jackie Robinson and immeasurable regard for what Jackie accomplished. I don't think he in any way wanted to take anything away from that. And certainly he was in the later years of his life, didn't feel that I don't think he felt that he was lacking any recognition. And so there's never been any push on by the Rickey family for that kind of limelight to be shined on Jackie. And we revel in this, I mean, to be shined on my grandfather.
Mm-hmm.
We revel in the attention that this 42 brings on the accomplishments that Jackie labored so hard and really impacted American society with what he did.
My guest is Branch B. Rickey. He's the grandson of Branch Rickey, and Branch B. Rickey is also the president of the AAA Pacific Coast League. If you have a question or comment for Branch B. Rickey, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org, or check out our Facebook page. It is the 66 years ago today that Jackie Robinson became the first African-American to play for a Major League Baseball team. A new film, 42, tells the story of how Robinson was recruited and signed by Branch Rickey, general manager of the Brooklyn Dodgers. Before we get started anymore, let's listen to a short clip from a trailer, from the trailer for the film, 42.
You want a player who doesn't have the guts to fight back?
No, I want a player who's got the guts not to fight back.
You give me a uniform, you give me a number on my back, and I'll give you the guts.
That's a subtle distinction, isn't it, Branch B. Rickey? I understand you were in L.A. at the premiere of the film. What did you think about how it was presented?
Well, this is the first time that the that couple of years has been portrayed in a major film. It had been done before. In fact, one film, The Robinson Story, even featured Jackie Robinson playing his own role. This one is going to have a much bigger splash. Of course, just simply on the name of Harrison Ford, who does portray my grandfather, the gargantuan status of Harrison Ford as a Hollywood figure, and as someone who's been in one successful film after another, will, I think, in and of itself draw attention to this this effort. And it really is an impacting film. There's an awful lot of emotion in the film. I don't think any audience is going to sit through it unstirred. There are, from a baseball standpoint, and such as myself, a grandson who has for so many years, decades and decades, followed the specifics of all of the episodes that were involved around this event, there are great liberties taken, of course. Mm-hmm. You can't capsulize what they're trying to capsulize in an hour and 50 minutes without some wonderful liberties being taken. I laugh at those. I don't mean to minimize them. Mm-hmm. I laugh at how they've creatively taken, but they've kept the value, they kept the spirit, they've kept the energy, they've kept the impact. And there isn't going to be anybody go to this movie and just sit through it casually. And from many fronts, there are a lot of different emotions that run through it.
Did you get a chance to meet Harrison Ford?
Better than that.
Wow!
No, you're gonna laugh, but you're gonna appreciate what I'm about to say.
Okay.
There was an after party across the street in a lot laid out that simulated a baseball field, and the field was painted on the ground, and tables of entrees and appetizers and hors d'oeuvres. And actors, various actors from the film, were circulating around as well as other Hollywood celebrities and so forth. And at one point, I did happen to have the good fortune to intersect with Harrison Ford, and I was dressed as was two cousins of mine who were along with me, who were about my age. The three of us all simulated an attire that my grandfather was well known for. We were all three wearing bow ties.
Uh-huh.
We kind of stuck out in that crowd. There were many more casually dressed California style attendees,
uh-huh.
And there were those in very formal dress. Well, we came across Harrison Ford, and there the three of us were in our bow ties. And somebody immediately gestured to him and said that those are the Rickey family folks, and so he came up and put an arm around me, and then I had a picture taken, and I cautioned him, and I immediately recognized what this was for really what it was. And I said, you need to take your arm from around me and put it around this woman right over here, my wife. If you wouldn't mind just putting your arm around her for a minute. And he then motioned to a Warner Brothers photographer who was kind of following him around. And so my wife has been photographed with Harrison Ford's arm around her, and I'm in good standing in my marriage. I want to tell you, I'm in very good standing.
Did you meet Chadwick Boseman, the man who, the actor who played Jackie Robinson?
Not on this occasion, no. But I have to tell you, the performance he gives, I think, just is off the charts.
It's
I was talking with Jackie's widow 2 years ago or so as she was anticipating her involvement in a production, and she said, who, Branch, would you think would play Jackie Robinson? And, of course, the only person I could think of that had that kind of persona, that kind of ability to translate to film the power that was Jackie Robinson on the field, I said to her, Denzel Washington. But he's way past that point of portraying a young 20s baseball player. And she said, yes, I've long thought that. So I was more or less resigned to the fact that while you could come up with some character who's such as Harrison Ford, who was going to try to pull off simulating my grandfather, which I couldn't imagine in advance, I really did not imagine there was somebody out there that was going to be able to portray Jackie in the way that Chadwick has. It is spellbinding.
It's an interesting cut we listened to earlier where he's telling him he wants somebody who doesn't have the guts to fight back. And the point of that was, of course, is that Jackie Robinson experienced a lot of hate and a lot of retribution and death threats and so forth for doing what he did. And you had to just keep playing.
Obviously. Well, you didn't have to. You didn't have to. Subsequent years afterwards, actually 50 years, in 1997, I was invited to a football banquet. I'm not quite sure how I got invited to a football banquet, but Jimmy Graham Brown and I were put at the same table, the running back for the Cleveland Browns, who is remembered in the minds of many of us who lived during his playing days to be, in those days, the greatest running back ever, and some of us still think he was the greatest running back ever in the NFL. He could both run with speed and run with power and sometimes hit the linebackers who were just savoring the opportunity to end Jimmy's career with one crushing blow. And time after time, Jimmy would come out of a pile and or end up at the bottom of a pile. And when he'd get up, so slowly that everybody thought, oh, my God, that was it. He's permanently injured. And then he'd get up and he'd barely make it back to the huddle, and of course they had called his number for carrying the ball the very next play. Naturally, they knew him, and the next down he'd run right through the center of the line and carry six people 10 yards again, or something. He was just seemingly invincible and retired early in his career. He leaned down during the dinner. He turned his chair halfway away from the table and pushed his plate away from him and turned towards me, seemingly wanting to talk, and I did the same. And as I turned towards him, we were just a round table of 10 people, and I found my forehead down about table level with his, equal with his. And he wanted to talk, and a couple of minutes into that, he said, you know who the most intense athlete is of probably modern times, any athlete I've ever seen? And I couldn't think of answering any way but, you, sir, you're the most intense athlete I think I've ever seen. And before I could think quite how to answer his question, he said, Jackie Robinson's the most intense athlete I've ever known in my life. Well, we don't think of intense athletes succeeding in baseball. And Jackie Robinson's intensity was his very biggest enemy. At the same time, it was his greatness. It was very much a dual-edged sword. My grandfather knew going into that anybody trying to tackle this assignment was going to be challenged, and challenged not to discredit the whole thing by just being what in those days would have been the person who perpetrated the movie will accentuate. I don't want to steal the plot in any way, but there was a burden on Jackie not strike. And the marvelous, marvelous, marvelous thing about it is this is a meeting between two men that lasted 3 hours. My grandfather enacted many scenes of how he would be taunted or harassed on the field, even physically, perhaps spiked and bloodied. And Jackie's face got up and said, "What would you do then?" And Jackie responded, "Mr. Rickey, you want an athlete who's afraid to fight back?" And my grandfather was perfectly prepared for that. "No, I want somebody with the I need somebody with the guts not to fight back." And if you look back at the 20th century, the great athletes of the 20th century, here we are having to tell so many people of today's day and age who they were: Babe Didrikson, or Rocky Marcian, or Joe Louis, or the greats of track and field, or boxing, or whatever you want, golf. But Jackie Robinson's legacy just keeps growing and growing and growing, yet he was not in any way, record-wise, equal to Jesse Owens, for example. And there are so many athletes that accomplished so many more statistical firsts and records, but Jackie Robinson shines above almost all of them, if not all of them, in our society.
For what he did.
It's an amazing thing, and it's not accidental. It's not accidental because he captured the heart of Americans with what he did and how he did it.
We're going to have to take a quick break. My guest is Branch B. Rickey. He's the grandson of Branch Rickey and president of the AAA Pacific Coast League. We're talking about the movie, the new film, 42, tells the story of how Jackie Robinson was recruited and signed by Branch Rickey. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Many parents dread it, agonize over where and when, but sooner or later, most sit their kids down for the talk. For Anna Fry, it's less about the birds and the bees and more about yes and no.
As a parent, I'm interested in teaching consent.
I'm Neil Conan, parents, children, and talking about sex. Next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Talk of the Nation this afternoon from 2 to 4 here on 89.7 NPR News. Expect showers and thunderstorms for today and a high of 72, more rain for tonight and a low of 49 degrees. A slight chance of rain continues on Friday, partly sunny and cooler, a high of 57. Support for All Sides comes from Ohio State's College of Arts and Sciences, presenting a new take on the tragic tale of Carmen. Performances of an unconventional chamber version take place April 13th and 14th at Ohio State's Thurber Theater. More information at music.osu.edu. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. This hour, we've been talking about the legacy of Branch Rickey and the part he played in breaking down the color barrier in baseball when he signed Jackie Robinson in 1947 to the Brooklyn Dodgers. That story is the basis of a new film, 42, that stars Harrison Ford, who plays Branch Rickey. In this clip from the film, Rickey explains to Robinson why he hired him.
40-odd years ago, I was a player coach at Ohio Wesleyan University. We had a Negro catcher, best hitter on the team. So I'm laid low, broken, because of the color of his skin, and I didn't do enough to help. I told myself I did, but I didn't. There was something unfair at the heart of the game I loved, and I ignored it. But a time came when I could no longer do that.
still with us is the grandson of Branch Rickey, Branch B. Rickey. And joining us now in the studio is Roger Ingalls. He's the athletic director at Ohio Wesleyan University, which is Branch Rickey Senior's, or I should say Branch Rickey, the grandfather's alma mater. Welcome to the show, Roger.
Thanks, Anne. It's my pleasure to be here.
Ohio Wesleyan University will celebrate the release of the National Feature 42 with a series of campus and community events commemorating the Rickey Robinson legacy. I was wondering, for more information, listeners, you can go to the link at our website at wosu.org/allsides to learn more about that. What do we know about what led Branch Rickey down the path to integrate the major leagues? He didn't do it lightly or on a whim, and we just heard that cut from the film. Roger Ingalls, do we know if that was the real inspiration for this?
I think it was a big part. I know Branch can fill us in a little bit more from the family side, but there was so much the Branch in 1904 as a young man coaching a team where one of his players was being told that he couldn't stay at a hotel. Charles Thomas was the catcher that was from Zanesville, Ohio, and Branch took him into his room. And I think that left a mark for him that down the road when he had the opportunity, which presented itself in Brooklyn in the mid-1940s, that he was going to do something to right a wrong. And, you know, this really became – I watched an interview last night with Harrison Ford, and he summed it up right when he said that this was a partnership between Branch Rickey and Jackie Robinson. It was something that they did together. And I think that really had its roots back in, you know, 1903 over in at Notre Dame University.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. With us today, Branch B. Rickey, grandson of Branch Rickey, and also Roger Ingalls, athletic director for Ohio Wesleyan University, the alma mater of Branch Rickey. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Jim in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Jim.
Hi. There's a tie to Columbus with the Rickey family. Mrs. Eckler was the daughter, and I wondered if Mr. Rickey could tell us about the status of the Rickey family today.
Branch B. Rickey, are you there?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Mary Eckler married to John Eckler. John Eckler became a partner in a law firm in Columbus, Bricker, Barton, and Eckler at the time. And I'm not current on its name today, but Mary was a longtime resident, and both of her daughters attended Ohio Wesleyan University. I think three of the five daughters of my grandfather attended Ohio Wesleyan for some part of their academic career, but currently there are two of the fifth generation of Rickeys that are applying for Ohio Wesleyan for acceptance for 2014. So it's I too am a graduate of Ohio Wesleyan. My father and mother were, and my both sisters. So in all, I think we have something close to 30 Rickey family members who have those ties. But yes, we did have a family in Columbus for an awful long time, and our of course my grandfather's roots go back to Portsmouth, Ohio. So we've got quite a footprint in that state.
Thanks a lot, Jim, for that call. Once again, 614-292-8513 is the number to call. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We have an email from RJ, who writes, "I'm a proud alumna of Ohio Wesleyan University, and Branch Rickey is a very well-known historical figure at the school. I believe Rickey also drafted Roberto Clemente, who played for the Pittsburgh Pirates. I think Mr. Rickey would be very happy to see how many different kinds of people are in Major League Baseball now. I know it was a fight, and a fight that he was central to. I wish I could have met him sometime, and I am happy his legacy is being carried on." Branch B. Rickey, did he when you talked to your grandpa about it, did he like the trajectory of baseball and where it headed, you know, in the days after he was directly involved?
My grandfather went over from the Dodgers to the Pittsburgh Pirates, and yes, he was involved with bringing Clemente there, and that more or less is seen as the breaking of the Latin barrier because of Clemente's accomplishments. And the but it was a pale thing by comparison to what Jackie had already established. The path for Clemente was so very simple. In comparison, just because of the barrier that Jackie had so dramatically shattered. My grandfather did live long enough. He passed away in 1965, and he lived long enough to see a much fuller complexion to the sport of baseball. Certainly, you had to have great satisfaction. I never heard him talk about it in quite that fashion. It just seemed that baseball reveled in all of the talented athletes that came from wherever they came from in the aftermath of Jackie.
David in Westerville, you're on the air. Welcome, David.
Yes, I'm on. Is it me you got?
You're on the air, right?
Thank you very much.
Welcome.
Question I have for your guest is, do they see parallels between Jackie Robinson and Barack Obama? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
A couple of firsts. Branch B. Rickey?
I thought that was directed at Roger.
Okay, Roger Ingalls?
Thanks, Branch. I think any time someone is a first is a challenge. And I think that they faced obstacles that others don't. When I look at the legacy that Branch Rickey left at Ohio Wesleyan, it's much more than the Charles Thomas. It's much more than the signing of Jackie Robinson. There's a story that very few people know about Ohio Wesleyan 7 months after Jackie Robinson entered the big leagues. We had a football team scheduled to go play Rollins College in Florida. And at that time, the Jim Crow laws did not allow for our team to compete because we had an African-American tailback, and African-Americans, blacks and whites, couldn't compete on the same field. Our team took a vote in 1947, and they voted to go without that tailback. And we had a board of trustees that happened to have a gentleman by the name of Branch Rickey on it, who passed the legislation, a piece of which at the time probably wasn't as significant as it's viewed now, but they passed a resolution that said at Ohio Wesleyan, any student who is eligible and able to compete will compete, or we won't compete at all. So our football team did not go to Rollins that year. They did go to Rollins in 1948 and compete with that tailback, Ken Woodward.
Things had changed.
And they have changed. And I think that when you look at what's happened in the political scene in America, you look at what's happened with civil rights legislation, anytime you have a first, it's going to bring about change. And we're very proud, like I say, of what's happened with Jackie Robinson and the effect on baseball, but also the effect on America. And I think Barack Obama has the same impact.
We talk a lot about Jackie Robinson being the first, but was Branch Rickey the first manager, you know, to try to do this? Had others tried Branch B. Rickey? Do we know if others had gone before him and tried and failed?
They had not. And, in fact, you have to appreciate that one for the season prior to 1947, Jackie Robinson was under contract to the Dodger organization. And as sort of a preliminary to coming up to the major leagues, he played in the minor league baseball at the level that I currently work, AAA baseball. He was with the Montreal Dodgers in the International League, and was extraordinarily successful there. But seeing that going on at the minor league level prompted a meeting. At that time, there were not 30
major league clubs as there are today. There were only 16, 8 in the National League and 8 in the American League. And in a meeting that was called of the two leagues getting together, with what I think afterwards we would see as somewhat of a contrived agenda of 2 points, suddenly there appeared a third point on the agenda. Discussion ensued as to the inappropriateness of an African-American, a Negro, being brought to the major leagues, and the clubs were asked to vote on that. And that caught my grandfather considerably by surprise. The vote passed 15-1 against allowing any major league club to bring a Negro to the major leagues. So these were my grandfather's peers. My grandfather came from that very modest background in southern Ohio, down outside of Portsmouth, a farm background. He really was in a very, very, very difficult position because he had spent decades trying to build his reputation and didn't come from any aristocracy or anything that would allow him the cushion to justify his brethren in baseball and go his own way. He really wanted to stay in the sport and wanted to be successful, but he faced the reality that if Robinson was going to come to the major leagues, he was going to have to defy all of his peers, the other 15 clubs entirely, and defy what they had passed as an agreement among them, that they would not allow an African-American to come to the major league. So that was still prevalent as of 1946, uniformly throughout the other 15 clubs. The only club that voted against it was the Dodgers.
So what happened to him when he defied them?
Well, fortunately, and I say fortunately, a great, great, great planning had gone into it for several years on his part, and there were many mechanisms put into place to try and give Robinson the support he needed to accomplish this. But in the end, truthfully, it rested on his ability to carry it off, both in performance on the field, to prove he was capable of performing at the major league level, and on a secondary level, he had to convince the fans that he was a good person. And that was what my grandfather thought could be accomplished by not fighting back, but by winning by performance. So Jackie carried a huge, huge, huge load on his shoulders every time he went to the plate. He was not just carrying the challenge of trying to hit successfully, but and along that line, if I digress for a quick second, Jackie got hit more by pitches. Was hit more by pitches in 1947 than the entire Brooklyn Dodgers team was hit in 1946.
Wow!
To give you a sense of what was going on. So he of course shouldered a huge load and did it so magnificently that it was impossible for the other 15 teams to now come down and try to carry out a facade that a Negro player was not capable of succeeding in Major League Baseball. He didn't just break a barrier, I would say to you, he didn't just break barrier. In my mind, he shattered what was a prevalent myth among that portion of our American society, that a Negro could not perform in our great American, couldn't handle the pressure, couldn't handle the sophistication, maybe you would say, needed to be a complete ball player, whatever that was. I even had a member of the Brooklyn Dodgers 50 years afterwards say to me, a member of Robinson's team, he had been a pitcher on that team. We were standing on a dais in the back as someone else was speaking, and he was reflecting. You could see he was up in years in his 80s, and he whispered to me as somebody was speaking for him, and he said, "You know, we thought we were going to win the pennant that year as we went into spring training. We thought we had the best team. What we didn't know was whether we could carry Robinson and still win it."
My guest is Branch B. Rickey. He's a grandson of Branch Rickey, and the president of the AAA Pacific Coast League, also with us in this studio, Roger Ingalls. He's the athletic director for Ohio Wesleyan University, the alma mater of Branch Rickey, who, of course, is the man who signed Jackie Robinson in 1947 to the Brooklyn Dodgers, thereby breaking down the color barrier in baseball. Coming up, we're going to be hearing from Bob Kendrick. He's president of the Negro League Baseball Museum. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, Lori Edwards, author of In the Kingdom of the Sick. She has a rare respiratory disease that wasn't accurately diagnosed until she was 23. We'll talk about living with chronic illness, how gender biases can affect diagnosis and treatment of chronic disease, and research into gender differences and how people experience pain and metabolize medicine. Join us.
Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes, starting at noon on 89.7 NPR News. And support our station right now and register to win an iPad Mini. Our spring membership drive begins soon, and by making your pledge right now, you'll be automatically entered to win. No pledge is necessary, and entries are only accepted at WOSU.org. The deadline is April 18th, and thanks for your support. And support comes from the Physicians Free Clinic and Voluntary Care Network, providing charity medical care for Central Ohio's uninsured patients. More about joining the Columbus Medical Association Foundation in supporting the clinic is at goodhealthcolumbus.org. Support also comes from Home Instead Senior Care, helping seniors in their homes, hospital, independent, or assisted living facilities, wherever they call home. More at homeinstead.com or 1-800-4-SENIORS. Home Instead Senior Care. To us, it's personal. All Sides continues. This is 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. This hour, we've been discussing the legacies of baseball legends Jackie Robinson and Branch Rickey. Still with us is Branch B. Rickey, grandson of Branch Rickey, and also Roger Ingalls, athletic director of Ohio Wesleyan University in Delaware. That was Branch Rickey's alma mater. Before Robinson played for the major leagues, he played as a member of the Negro League's Kansas City Monarchs. Let's listen to a clip from an interview with Jackie Robinson's wife, Rachel Robinson, where she describes what Jackie told her about his first meeting with Branch Rickey.
I was in California when he met with Rickey, and he called me. He said he sensed that this was a man who was going to stand behind it. It was not just a gimmick and just a trial or experiment. This is a man who believed in things like family, like commitment, like, you know, he wanted him on the team, and he was going to help him stay there.
So it was something of an attraction for Robinson. It didn't take just anybody to ask him to change leagues like that. Joining us now to discuss Robinson's time with the Monarchs and how his departure to the majors impacted them is Bob Kendrick. He's president of the Negro League Baseball Museum in Kansas City, Missouri. Welcome to the show, Bob.
And thanks so much for having me on.
Tell us, give us a quick tutorial on the Negro League, when it was founded, how long it lasted, and what it meant.
Negro Leagues were established here in Kansas City in 1920, right around the corner from where the museum operates, and the old Paseo YMCA, a contingent of eight independent black baseball team owners, met here, established the Negro National League, the first successful organized black baseball league. The leagues would then go on to operate for 40 years, from 1920 until 1960. And of course, it created a playing ground for some of the greatest black and Hispanic baseball players to showcase their world-class baseball skills. It would grow to become the third largest black-owned business in this country. And of course, as you mentioned in your opening, it would be the league that would give us Jackie Robinson.
How did it manage financially? You said it was the third largest black-owned business in the country. Was it big business?
It was big business.
Mm-hmm.
It was big business. It only trailed black-owned insurance companies who, during that era of segregation, emerged and would insure African-Americans more than 10 or 15 cents that the white insurance companies would insure us. Back then, the white insurance companies would insure African Americans just enough to bury us, a 10 or 15 cent policy. Black-owned insurance companies came about, not only insured my livelihood, but insured my stock, my crop, my home, and as a result, made millions of dollars. You know, next, of course, was the legendary Madam C.J. Walker with the School of Cosmetology. And of course, Madam C.J. had schools of cosmetology in every major urban city in this country, and she becomes the first woman of any skin color to earn $1 million with a business structure. And then next was Negro Leagues Baseball. And if my dear friend, the late, great John Buck O'Neill, was still alive, he'd tell you all you needed was a bus, two sets of uniforms, and you'd have 20 of the greatest athletes who ever lived. They could play. They could play, and really, Ann, their contemporaries knew that they could play. It was just simply the social conditions of our time and fear that kept them out of the major league.
Now, Jackie Robinson, we were talking earlier, he was an incredible athlete by any measure. He was a multi-talented athlete, could do many, many things, but he wasn't necessarily, his stats weren't necessarily the absolute best at the time. Who were his contemporaries, the really big stars that we don't hear about because they didn't get that chance that Jackie Robinson got?
Yeah, you know, if this had happened earlier, we'd be talking about the likes of Buck Leonard or Josh Gibson or Cool Papa Bell or Willard Brown, who did get the opportunity to go over to the major leagues. He couldn't handle the social aspect of it. It was too challenging socially for him. But there were so many great players, Ray Dandridge, Martin DeHigo. All of these guys would have been superstars in the major leagues had the doors opened sooner. Oscar Charleston. They got an old Satchel Paige, you know, and Satchel was still winning at the major league level, even though they say he was 42 and he was probably closer to 52 than 42. I don't know if anyone really knows Satchel's real age.
Or 62.
That was Branch B. Ricky. You said or 62. Okay.
And still able to throw the ball by major league hitters.
Still doing it at whatever age, whether it was 42, 52, 62, was absolutely amazing what Satchel was able to do so late in his career and after playing for so long.
Did the Negro League players make a decent living? Of course, even, you know, the major league players at the day, they weren't making like what they're making today.
Yeah, you know, the superstar Negro Leaguer could earn a really good living. Satchel Paige was one of the highest paid players in the country of any skin color, but he was doing it because he was playing year-round. And so along the barnstorming circuits, everybody wanted to see Satchel pitch. So he pitched two or three innings almost every single day. And, of course, Satchel, being the savvy businessman that he was, would negotiate a percentage of the gate. And so he was this huge gate attraction. So Satchel was, you know, but the other guys would either go to Latin America and play winter ball, just as the major leaguers did, and they could earn extra money. And some of the guys would actually jump from the Negro Leagues to go play in Latin America because they were making much more money in Latin America. But they could earn a decent salary playing a game. They were stars within their own community. They were still being paid more than the average working professional in this country. And so the salaries may not have been at the level of those major leaguers at that time, but, you know, still pretty comparable in many sets of circumstances.
What was the audience for the Negro League back then at that point?
Believe it or not, they played before integrated crowds.
Mm-hmm.
You know, here in Kansas City, they played at old Mule Box Stadium, which eventually became Municipal Stadium, and there were as many white fans watching those games as there were black fans. And that was the case pretty much throughout the country, particularly during World War II. We saw a large proliferation of white fans venturing over to watch Negro Leagues baseball because while the Negro League certainly got hit by World War II, the superstar Negro League players were a little bit too old. And so you still had Gibson and Paige and Bell and guys like that who were still playing during that time. And so they were filling up ballparks all over the country. And so a lot of white fans. And what struck me about it is that Negro League games, there really wasn't any separation between the two races. They sat together. At major league games, if black fans were oftentimes allowed in, we were separated by chicken wire barriers. But at Negro League games, you know, white fans sat there with black fans, and for 2 hours, color was really of no significance. And then we'd all go back into our own separate worlds.
There was some conflict between the Negro League owners and Branch Rickey's plan to integrate the majors. Of course, that had to be bittersweet.
Yeah. Bittersweet. Oh, Oh, it was, because we look at Robinson's Breaking of the Color Barrier as the beginning, but also the end. And so from that respect, it is bittersweet, because he creates this groundswell of opportunity for players of color to go work in an environment that had excluded them from working. But by doing so, and the siphoning of talent that would ultimately leave the Negro Leagues, it killed the Negro League. The Negro Leagues would eventually dissolve, because now there's no need for two professional leagues. And so that older Negro League player, you know, the Negro Leagues didn't want him because they couldn't sell him to the Major Leagues. The Major Leagues didn't want him because he was too old. So they would either have to go to Canada or back to Latin America if they were going to, you know, resume their playing career. So it is bittersweet from that standpoint. But, you know, and that is the case with progress in general. There's always a cost for progress. And in this case, the Negro Leagues and black businesses in general paid a little bit of a cost for this great progress, because with integration became the opportunities for us to do business anywhere we wanted to. And so now these smaller black businesses could no longer compete, and they end up perishing. And so it is bittersweet from that standpoint, well, but it was so good for the soul of our country, and it moved us in ways in which we never fathomed.
Do you think, though, that, well, I mean, maybe it's starting now, but well, the black managers, black owners, you know, all of those other parts of the system were held back for many years.
Oh, there's no question, because what baseball focused on was the field.
Yeah.
And as you just alluded to, you had an entire black baseball business operation. You know, every functioning aspect of a business as it related to baseball was being managed and operated by African Americans as part of the Negro Leagues. Baseball focused primarily on the field. So we get Jackie in 1947. You get your first black coach in Major League Baseball in 1962 with the late, great Buck O'Neill. You get your first black manager, you know, in the early 1970s with Frank Robinson. And then your first black GM even later than that. So the hierarchy in baseball was very slow. It was basically focusing on the field.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We have an email from John in Columbus, and I just kind of want to direct it out to all three of my guests, including Roger Ingalls, athletic director for Ohio Wesleyan University, who's in the studio with me, and Branch B. Rickey, grandson of Branch Rickey, and also Bob Kendrick, president of the Negro League Baseball Museum. It's from John in Columbus, and he asks, how do you feel about the declining number of African-Americans playing baseball these days, and what can be done to reverse that trend? And he's asking Branch B. Rickey in particular, how do you think your grandfather would feel about it? Branch B. Rickey, why don't you kick it off?
After listening to how eloquent Bob Kendrick was on that last one, I hesitate to try to jump in on this and rival him. And I feel the same about Roger's previous one, response about Obama. You know, I think Bob can probably speak better to this, because it is not so much a matter of the opportunity that is there in front of minority students and minority athletes at the high school or collegiate level, but it is a question of their priorities and their direction and why they choose. But there is clearly a diminished participation in professional baseball by minority athletes. At least when we're talking about Negro African American athletes. So for that part of it, and I would argue that my grandfather would have great concern on that front. With that, I would pass it to Bob.
Bob Kendrick?
Well, I tell you what, and Mr. Rickey, I certainly believe your grandfather would also share the same kind of concern that we as an institution share. You know, obviously, we want every child to be able to play this great game of baseball and be able to allow this game to take you wherever it could. And whether that is to the professional ranks, that's one thing, but there are so many things that come from our sport. It is of concern. You know, here we are an institution where you can walk into this museum and you can see black folks who played this game as well as anyone ever played this game. And as we talked about early, not only played the game, but ran a business of baseball. And so to see those numbers of African-American-born blacks move from 27, 28% in its height in the 70s down to about 7.5-8% now is certainly alarming. The commissioner has, of course, just on yesterday announced a task force to examine this. And it's not institutional racism as it was before. It is now about building interest and making sure that we can create every opportunity for kids to play this sport. You know, here is the demand is the demand for these players are there. The supply is not. And we have got to figure out ways in which we can get urban kids excited about playing this game. I think there are a number of variables and that come into play. Some of them are socioeconomic. Some of them are the rapid rise of those other sports, basketball and football. And you know, we can't say definitively what that issue is. What we know is it's going to take a sustained effort. This is not going to be a quick fix.
Well, you know, Bob Kendrick, Jackie Robinson played many different kinds of sports.
Yes.
Four or five different kinds of sports. That doesn't happen nowadays. And I was wondering, Roger Ingalls, you know, what your concern is about that. They all have to be one sport athletes by the time they graduate from high school.
And I think that's a major concern at the college level. I think it's a concern nationally. I think it plays into the fact that we have fewer numbers in baseball now than we've had. You fly into any city and you fly over ballparks and they're usually empty. When we were a kid, I used to ask my players, I said, how many of you ever got 100 hits in one day? And they'd look at you like you were crazy. I said, well, we used to go down to the Sandlot and you play baseball from daylight to dark and you'd get 100 hits in one day. And, you know, kids did that all the time. Now they can't play unless they have the full uniform. They have umpires and they have all the other things. You just don't see kids doing things like we used to when we grew up. And we've got to reinvest. I think cities have got to reinvest in their rec centers. I mean, you look at just the city of Columbus, how many rec centers have been closed in the last few years, and that's where kids used to go and get the experiences. And Major League Baseball has got to do a better job of reinvesting in the urban areas and getting kids out playing the game.
Well, 66 years ago today, Jackie Robinson joined the major leagues. Quite a day. We didn't plan it that way. We just aren't that lucky in live radio. But I want to thank my guests for joining us today. Bob Kendrick, president of the Negro League Baseball Museum. Bob, thanks so much for joining us. It's very interesting.
Oh, and thanks so much for having me, and it's great to hear Mr. Ricky. I'm so glad. I'm so excited about this movie, and I hope you agree with me in Harrison Ford's amazing role portraying your grandfather.
As is Chadwick Boseman in portraying Jack.
Branch B. Ricky, grandson of Branch Ricky, thank you for joining us today as well. We really appreciate it.
And a wonderful program. I feel privileged to have been invited. Thank you.
And Ohio Wesleyan University Athletic Director Roger Ingalls. Roger, thanks for joining us again.
Oh, thank you. It was my pleasure.
And thanks to everybody for listening. Thanks to the All-Sides staff. Producer Michael DeBonis, Associate Producer Amy Jurevich, Assistant Producers Corinne Gleckler and Rachel Quimby, Production Assistants Kiram Shaban and Leticia Wiggins, with video production by Rich Karsmitsky and Amber Karsmitsky. Alan DeCenzo is the composer of our theme music. Thanks again for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is listener-supported WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus, and streaming on the web at WOSU.org, 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station, a service of WOSU Public Media.